15th and 1 p.m. On today's agenda, we have the legislative auditor here to go over his report on governance of transit in the Twin Cities region. And Mr. Nobles, we have Jim Nobles, the legislative auditor, and Judy Randall, the evaluation manager for this particular audit report. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Judy Randall, who was the manager of this evaluation. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for setting aside some time in your busy schedule to consider this report. In recent years, the Twin Cities metropolitan region has had significant advances in transit. Some have even called this the golden age of transit. One thing is clear, the advances that have been made resulted from the leadership and hard work of many individuals, people who stepped up, took charge, made tough decisions, and delivered good service. So some have asked, why then did the legislative auditor issue a report on January the 21st of this year that was critical of transit governance in the Twin Cities metropolitan region? If so much has been accomplished, what's the problem? Well, in our view, the problem is structure, not people. People have performed well, but the governance structure for transit in the Twin Cities metropolitan region is far from ideal. As you will hear and see in Ms. Randall's presentation, the structure of governance for transit in the Twin Cities metropolitan region is complex, fragmented, and it has overlapping responsibilities among numerous organizations. The Metropolitan Council is, of course, heavily involved, but so are counties, both individually and through various county-based organizations. And then there are the cities and the so-called opt-out transit organizations. In some respects, this intense level of involvement across several layers of government has helped move certain parts of the transit system forward. But the complexity and fragmentation and overlapping responsibilities have also fostered distrust and conflict and made coordination and consensus building more difficult. Therefore, we should ask, and we do ask in this report, is this the governance structure that will serve the Twin Cities region well going into the future, as the desire and need for even more transit grows and resources tighten even further? We don't think so. We think reform is needed. But we acknowledge that reform will not be easy to accomplish. The people who have worked hard and taken risk to advance their vision of transit are not going to simply step aside to create a simpler organization chart. Transit leaders in the Twin Cities region are proud of their achievements and the organizations they represent. We respect their accomplishments, their organizations, and we even understand their suspicions about reform. Therefore, we do not recommend quick, complete consolidation. We don't think that would either be possible or fair. Rather, we recommend a sequential process beginning with changing the composition of the Metropolitan Council. We start there because we think that is the root of the problem. The proliferation of transit organizations we have today, the County Improvement Transportation Board, CTIB, the opt-outs, rail authorities, the Transit Advisory Board, TAB, and others reflect a history of state and local elected officials working around the Metropolitan Council to advance certain parts of the region's transit system. Some say that those workarounds reflect simply temporary political situations. We see the problem as more deeply embedded in the structure of the Metropolitan Council. As you well know, the Metropolitan Council is a very important policymaking body in this region. Its decisions Certainly, its transit decisions affect every local community in the region. Yet only appointees of the governor serve at the council's table. This governance structure has long been characterized by many as lacking accountability. We think it also undermines the Metropolitan Council's credibility, particularly among elected officials that represent communities that are impacted by council decisions. There are various ways that the legislature could address concerns about the council's accountability and credibility. We discussed several possibilities in our report. Our preferred solution is to simply put some city and county elected officials from the region on the council. To tell you more about what we found and what we recommend, I'd like to call on Ms. Randall to make a presentation of our report. And again, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nobles, for the report and the good work that went into this, and we appreciate the depth of it and your the recommendations. I've heard this before, and so I appreciate the work that you have done, Ms. Randall, the work that you have done on this also, and look forward to your input on this and to bringing the Transportation Committee here in the Senate up to speed on it. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm an evaluation coordinator with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And as Mr. Noble said, we're pleased to be here today to talk with you about our evaluation of governance of transit in the Twin Cities region. Before I get started, I would like to acknowledge my colleagues who also worked hard on this evaluation, seated here behind me, Julie Trepke and Emmy Bennett. Let me give you a quick overview of what we're going to cover in the presentation and what our evaluation covered. First, we looked at certain types of transit in the region, in particular regular route bus transit, which includes express and local service, light rail transit, commuter rail transit, and BRT. We did not look at dial-a-ride, such as Metro Mobility or Vanpool. And just to give you some context, in 2009, the region spent about $319 million providing these types of transit to the region, and there were about 81 million rides. I'm going to jump to the end and kind of give you the highlights on where we're headed with our key legislative recommendations. The first one, which Mr. Nobles alluded to, is we recommend the legislature restructure the Metropolitan Council. We also recommend the legislature extend the transit taxing district. We recommend that the legislature allow consideration of the Dan Patch Corridor, which is a potential commuter rail corridor that runs from Northfield to Minneapolis. And we recommend the legislature clarify the goals and priorities of transit in the Twin Cities region. As we set out to do this evaluation, we looked at the goals for transit in the region, and frankly, they were scattered across a couple of different statutes, and their priorities weren't clear. We make a number of other recommendations in the report that I won't really touch on in the presentation unless there are questions. So if you want to see the full list, they're listed on pages 125 and 126 in the full report. So let me back up, give a little bit of our findings and how we arrived at these recommendations. First, I'm going to start with the good news, which is we found the region's transit system performs relatively well. We compared the performance of the Twin Cities transit region with 11 peer regions, including Denver and Seattle, and we compared their performance on a whole host of different performance measures. First set were efficiency measures, which are like cost-effectiveness measures. They included things such as operating cost per passenger and the fare recovery percentage, which is the percentage of total operating costs covered by passenger fares. And when we looked at these efficiency measures, we found that the Twin Cities region performed relatively well. On many of these measures, such as fare recovery percentage and subsidy per passenger, we ranked second among the 11 peers, and you can see fourth on the operating cost per passenger. But across all of these efficiency measures, the Twin Cities region ranked in the top third among the peers. You can see on these efficiency measures, San Diego ranked the highest, and Dallas-Fort Worth and Pittsburgh ranked the lowest. But one of the things we did was look at a whole host of different measures because, as I mentioned, the goals for transit aren't clear. And depending on what the goals are, that's what you would want to measure. You'd want to align your performance measures with the goals. So we also looked at access measures and service use measures. Service use measures are those where look at the existing amount of service provided and evaluate how much of that service is being used. When we looked at the service use measures, again, we found that the Twin Cities region ranked relatively well, again, in the top third among the peers. But this time you'll notice that the best region is no longer San Diego. Now it's Baltimore and Portland. And the worst region is now Tampa. So a couple of kind of big conclusions to draw from our performance measure work. The first is that across all the different performance measures we looked at, the Twin Cities region performed well, again, consistently in the top third among the peer regions. However, the region that performed best or worst on any set of measures changed. And I think what that showed us is the importance of having the measures match up with your goals, because different regions, different providers within a region are going to look good or bad depending on what measure you're using. So our philosophy and our recommendation to the legislature and the council is to use as many measures as you can to get the most complete picture of how the region is doing on its transit. So that was the good news, but we weren't actually asked to look at performance of transit in the region. Instead, we were asked to look at the governance structure. And that's where we found that the structure is far from ideal. And we felt the best way to show this is to kind of depict through an illustration how the structure is, how the transit governance structure is in the region. So at the center is the Metropolitan Council, which, as you know, has two divisions, Metro Transit and Metropolitan Transportation Services. Metro Transit is the operating arm for the Met Council. It operates the Metro Transit buses, light rail, and commuter rail. Metropolitan Transportation Services contracts out for some bus services, manages the Dial-A-Ride program, and also is the transit planning arm for the agency. Now, in state law, the Metropolitan Council is identified as the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization. By federal law, the MPO is required to have local elected representation, but the Met Council does not have local elected representation because all members are appointed by the governor. So in the Twin Cities region, we also have TAB, the Transportation Advisory Board. TAB has 33 members, 17 of whom are local elected officials. So together, TAB and the Met Council jointly perform those MPO responsibilities. Now, in addition to the Met Council and TAB, we have the seven county regional railroad authorities, a regional railroad authority for each of the counties in the seven county region. These regional railroad authorities have the ability to levy a tax for rail purposes for things such as studying, developing rails, including light rail and commuter rail projects. And then in the seven county region, you also have the county boards for each of the seven counties that are also involved in making transit decisions in the region. Now, the same set of county commissioners serve on both a county's board and its regional railroad authority, but this adds a whole other layer of county organizations that transit planners and transit providers need to work with in the region. In 2008, the legislature authorized the counties in the seven county region to levy a quarter cent sales tax for transit purposes. And the legislation also allowed those counties to create a joint powers board, which now is called CTIB, that would make the decisions on how to spend the money raised through that quarter cent sales tax.
Can we take questions as we go?
Whatever you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Randall, I was wondering if you could talk. When you mentioned that the Railroad Authority has taxing authority, can you tell me how that's implemented and to what degree do those regional rail authorities have taxing jurisdiction, and how do they implement that tax?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to answer the best I can, and I might need to follow up with you after the hearing. But the regional railroad authorities have the ability to levy. It's a fairly low tax rate. I don't have it right at my fingertips. I don't know if Senate staff has any more information, not to put them on the spot. and they levy it. All of the counties in the region do levy this levy amount, and then they use it for planning, for looking at converting rails to trails or developing or purchasing rights of ways for future rail development.
Follow up,
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, they can also use that to participate in joint powers agreements.
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. Yes, they also participate, and I'm about to show you at the bottom, there's different corridor commissions and task force, so they may use that money to help fund a study of a specific corridor, for example.
Thank you.
Ms. Randall?
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to back us up here. So the six counties in green show the counties in the region that have chosen to levy the quarter cent sales tax, and those five counties, Washington, Anoka, Ramsey, Hennepin, and Dakota, are all voting members of CTIB and help decide how to allocate the money generated through that sales tax. Carver and Scott County have chosen to not levy that quarter cent sales tax and are at the table at CTIB meetings, but they are non-voting members. The 1981 legislature created what we call the suburban transit providers, or commonly called the opt-outs. In 1981, the legislature allowed certain communities to opt out of the regional transit system and form their own transit services. Six suburban transit providers, they're listed in red: Shakopee Transit, Maple Grove Transit, et cetera, now serve 12 communities in the south and west suburbs. Collectively, these six providers provide about 7% of the bus rides in the region. As I mentioned, there are also a number of commissions and task force and alliances throughout the region. I've listed five here, but frankly, there are many, many more that would fill up the screen. And these are commissions and task force that form along a certain corridor composed of municipalities and interest groups who are interested in developing or studying transit along a specific corridor. Now, you'll see on the screen that there are no lines of hierarchy, or there's no hierarchical structure here. We've likened it more to a spider web, frankly, because each of these organizations has a distinct role and has some independence, but also has an overlapping role and some interdependence with the other organizations on the screen. So, for example, CTIB has the autonomy to determine how to spend the quarter cent sales tax revenue that its members raise. But the spending decisions must be consistent with the Metropolitan Council's transportation policy plan and with general guidelines in the region. Similarly, the suburban transit providers can decide the nature and frequency and amount of service provided in their communities, but the service must be consistent with the Met Council's regional transit procedures, and it also must be consistent with federal regulations. So again, each of these has some independence, but some interdependence with the other organizations in the region. So when we looked at this structure, we found a number of challenges. The first one hopefully won't surprise you, that there's a lot of fragmentation and complexity, and I think that would be evident from the slide that was on the screen before this one. Now, complexity in of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing, and if people work well together, you know, complexity can be overcome. And just because it looks difficult or complex on paper doesn't mean that in reality it's a difficult thing. But what we found is a significant amount of distrust among many of the transit organizations in the region, in particular a lot of distrust between the Metropolitan Council and the suburban transit providers. And that distrust makes the fragmentation and the complexity that much more difficult for people to work through. We also found that there's a lot of time-consuming coordination. You know, there's all of these organizations that are involved in transit planning and decisions. There's coordination needed among all of them. And then when you layer in the distrust, it makes that coordination even more difficult. And then finally, we found that there are not agreed-upon set of priorities for where to develop transit ways in the future. So there's all of this local energy, which everyone we spoke with, and we spoke with a lot of people involved in transit in the region, agreed that the local activity and the local energy is really important to making things happen kind of out in the communities regarding transit. But understandably, each of those local groups thinks their local project is the most important one. And there's not an agreed upon set of priorities for the region about how to evaluate which one of those projects should move forward next. We're not talking about whether Central Corridor should go next or even if Southwest Corridor should go next. We're talking about Botineau Boulevard versus Red Rock versus Rush Line. And there's no agreed-upon set of priorities based on ridership projections or cost projections about which one should happen. And when we spoke with people, there was pretty widespread belief that the next transitway to be built was going to be either the one that was ready next, that had kind of jumped through all the planning hoops first, or the one for which there was the most capital or political capital. Again, not necessarily the one based on priorities for the region. So when we looked at all the challenges from the governance structure and we're thinking about, well, what would make this work better? What would make it be more streamlined and more transparent? We kind of naturally looked to the Metropolitan Council as the transit planning organization in the region. However, when we did that, we found that the composition of the council itself has contributed to many of the challenges we found. As you know, Council members are appointed by the governor. Governor Dayton just completed his appointments last week. And because of the fact that they're appointed rather than elected, they have limited accountability to the public. Now, that is despite the fact that the council does levy a tax in the transit taxing district, but they're not elected by the residents. We also found that the nature in which the members get to the council leads to limited credibility of the council with stakeholders and other transit organizations in the region. You know, as Mr. Nobles mentioned, there's a lot of local energy, a lot of local community leaders, a lot of local elected officials who are heavily involved in transit, very connected to their community, working towards and making a lot of decisions about transit in their community. But then ultimately, they have to work with the council, who is a group of appointed members who doesn't necessarily have that link to the local community or that credibility with the local community. We also found that the way the council members are appointed leads to limited stability with the council. You know, as I said, Governor Dayton just appointed his members last week. All but one of the 17 members are new. Well, 16 members in the chair. So 16 of the 17 are new to the council. When we were talking to people in the fall, what we heard was a lot of questioning about what the priorities were going to be for the new council and why should people invest a lot of time and energy into the priorities of the former council. So, for example, in the summer and fall, the council was working on a transitway guidelines initiative. It was requiring a lot of time and energy from a lot of local stakeholders. And we heard from many of them saying, why should we spend time on this now? Who knows if this is going to be a priority of the next council? Let's just wait and see what the next council wants to do rather than investing a lot of time into this. So the complete turnover or almost complete turnover of the council really hampers the council's ability as well to be effective. Finally, we found that the composition of the council itself has contributed to the large number of transit organizations in the region. There have been times when the legislature has actually gone around the Met Council, created new transit organizations to get things done. CTIB, I think, is the best example of this. In 2008, when the counties were willing to levy the tax, the quarter-cent sales tax, rather than having the Met Council levy the sales tax, or rather than having the legislature levy the sales tax itself, the legislature went around the council, authorized the counties to levy the sales tax, and authorized the creation of CTIB, adding yet another layer of organizations into the region. Similarly, with the suburban transit providers in 1981, rather than working with the regional transit provider, the legislature went around the regional transit provider and allowed these communities to develop their own service providers. So when we took all of this into account, this is what led us to our key recommendation, which is that the legislature should restructure the Metropolitan Council. We considered a number of different governance options and ultimately recommend a mix of appointed and elected members. We think having some elected members would help give the council some credibility, additional credibility with the local communities it works. But we do think it's important to have some appointed members as well. We think appointed members can provide a good regional perspective. We recommend that these members serve staggered terms. That would help with the stability problem that we just spoke about. And overall, these would improve the accountability, the credibility, and the stability of the Metropolitan Council, which we think could then lead to more streamlined governance. Now, we fully acknowledge that changing the composition of the council itself is not going to solve all of the challenges we saw in the governance of transit. It's not going to make that messy slide all of a sudden magically neat and easier to understand. But we think restructuring the council is the first necessary step to then taking additional steps to streamline governance. So let me talk a little bit more about some of those other recommendations that we think could follow. The first is regarding the Transportation Advisory Board. As I mentioned, TAB is in place largely to meet federal requirements to have local elected official representation for the region's MPO. If the Met Council now has local elected representation on it, you would no longer need TAB to satisfy those federal requirements, and we think TAB could be eliminated. We considered recommending eliminating CTIB. Ultimately, we decided if the counties are the ones responsible for levying the tax, then the county should be the one with the authority on how to spend that revenue. If, however, the legislature gives the authority to levy that tax to the council, or if the legislature changes the composition of the council in such a way that counties are really intimately involved in it, then perhaps CTIB could be eliminated. But at this point, with the counties levying the sales tax, we think it makes sense for CTIB to stay in place. Throughout our evaluation, we heard concerns about a conflict of interest with having Metro Transit and the Met Council being co-located in one agency. there were concerns that as the planning entity, the Met Council could kind of direct planning to benefit Metro Transit. We didn't see evidence of that, and we do think there's some benefits to having them in the same organization. Additionally, some initiatives that the council has done in the past fall regarding transitway guidelines and regional transit procedures, we think those things help to provide more transparency and consistency in the region, and we think that those initiatives will alleviate the concerns about conflict of interest. We also considered recommending eliminating the suburban transit providers. You know, I think if we were starting from scratch, we would not design a system where you have six transit providers providing 7% of the bus rides in the region. You know, it's probably not the most efficient, cleanest way to do it. But we're not starting from scratch, and the suburban transit providers have done a good job of serving the communities that they serve. So we don't recommend for the elimination of suburban transit providers. That being said, there are six of them. Four of them are city-based and basically provide services in their city. And we think there are some natural partners for consolidation. In particular, we recommend that Maple Grove Transit and Plymouth Metrolink consolidate, and we recommend that Shakopee Transit and Prior Lake Transit consolidate. We think this would make their services more efficient, and at least on the margins, it would help to reduce the number of transit organizations in the region. We make a number of other non-governance-related recommendations in the report. I'll highlight two here now, but I'm happy to take questions on any of them. The first is that the legislature extend the transit taxing district to include all communities under the council's jurisdiction. And in the report on page 66, there's a map showing the communities in the Twin Cities region that are subject to the regional transit capital levy. And if you look at the map on 66, you'll see in the middle is kind of a lighter shaded group of communities. Those are the regions that are subject to the levy. The outer ring, the darker gray, are the regions or the municipalities that are not subject to the transit capital levy. As its name suggests, the transit capital levy is used for transit capital purposes, things such as building park and ride facilities or purchasing buses. And we make the recommendation to extend the transit taxing district to all communities for a number of reasons. The first is that the Met Council already views the whole seven-county area as its service area, and it already provides dial-a-ride services to all communities in its seven-county area, not just those in the transit taxing district, although those funds help go to purchase the dial-a-ride buses. Additionally, the council has done a park-and-ride study to see where people are coming from that use its park-and-rides, and they found that 10 to 14% of the users of the park-and-ride facilities come from that darker gray ring, so the communities that are not paying the transit capital levy but are using the services nonetheless. And finally, we make the recommendation because if a community chooses to join the transit taxing district, it has an opportunity to talk with the council about its service needs and potential service levels. And in a way, it gives that community an ability to negotiate. It gives that community a little more leverage in terms of getting services. It's not to say that the community gets a level of service that's not warranted, but it does give them a little bit of extra access. So we think that for all of those reasons, we recommend extending the transit taxing district to include all communities. And then finally, we recommend that the legislature allow consideration of the Dan Patch Corridor. Again, that's the potential commuter rail corridor that runs from Northfield to Minneapolis. The language in law is very broad in terms of prohibiting any study, discussion, mention of the Dan Patch Corridor. The law actually forbids or prohibits Met Council and MnDOT from mentioning Dan Patch Corridor except for historical purposes. And we're not recommending that Dan Patch Corridor be built. You know, we're not recommending that it not be built. But what we're saying is if we're expecting the region to act like a region and use, you know, things like ridership and cost projections and data to make decisions about where transit should be developed, then the region should be able to consider all potential corridors. And so in that regard, we suggest at least allowing a discussion about Dan Patch Corridor. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'll end the formal part of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions. This is not what I would say is my area of expertise, so if they're not good questions, I'm sorry in advance. But you talked about the outer ring having roughly about a 14% use. Mm-hmm. And my question is if they were levied, how much. But my thought is that they potentially could be paying a lot more than what they use it. But I just want to know what your thoughts are about that.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for the question. I don't have the numbers in front of me. The rate is relatively low, and it's a small range, and I will look to see if I can find it. I believe it's in a footnote here, how much the range is of the tax. But it's not jumping out at me. So here we go. On page 67, the levy rate ranged from 1.203% to 1.278%. So it's a pretty tight range, and it's levied on households. So in terms of population, of course, there's a much denser population where the capital levy is where the capital tax is being levied. So in terms of amount being raised, would that outer ring represent 14% of the revenue? I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I either could get them or I'm sure someone from the Met Council could get that for you.
Senator Gazalka, did you have a follow-up?
Not on that, so I'll let Senator Dibble.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That would be interesting, and I think what would be interesting, I think I understand from previous conversations about this issue, I don't think it would approach the 14%. But the principle at play here is that folks in this gray area are using the transit system and not contributing anything to its capital costs at all. And they're taking advantage. They're driving in and hopping on the buses, and they're able to access the dial-a-ride for vehicles that go out to pick them up. So there's, you know, even if they come in at less than 14%, even though they're using 14% of the system, there's an important principle at play here.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, too, on that point, and it takes it just one step further, but I think it's worth mentioning, and that is, and there could well be differences of opinion on this point, that you can certainly consider transit a public good, that it isn't directly a consumer good, that you pay a dollar and you get a dollar back in service or of a product, because there are some indirect impacts on all of us, whether we use transit. I live in St. Paul, Ramsey County. We pay the tax. And so it has, I think, some benefit for me. Even if I don't ride transit, it gets some other people into transit off the interstate that I might be driving on. So there could be some reduction in congestion that could create a benefit for those that aren't directly using transit. So I think it is there are various principles involved here. And to the degree that you consider it a public good, as we do, for example, schools, public schools. There are many people that pay a tax for public education, public schools, that don't directly participate, but they gain some advantage to the greater community. And Mr. Chair, since I'm talking, I might just, and Senator Howe is back, and he asked a question about the regional rail authorities. I just want to refer to you to page 11. It will give you the statutory authorization and language and a citation you could follow up on as to the authority that these county rail authorities have to use the money. So the language is there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. The Senate Council did share with me it's very similar to the amount that a port authority can levy, but it has to be done by referendum first to grant the regional rail the authority to levy, and so I did read that statute. Thank you.
And as you'll see, the uses of those revenues are quite broad. The authorization for uses that are quoted there, quite extensive.
Senator Gazalka?
Another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question on a different subject. When you were talking about suburban transit providers and maybe wishing we maybe didn't start that way, why not one even today, at least for the upper management positions? I mean, I can see if you have six or seven different ones or whatever it comes down to, each one has a top-level position, and I'm just wondering what the reasoning behind not eventually moving to one is.
Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Gazalka. I think it's a fair question, and it's one that we struggled with quite a bit as we were moving towards our recommendations. And ultimately, I think we went where our findings took us, which is that the suburban transit providers are doing a good job serving their communities. They have developed good systems. They are hooked in with their communities and serving a need. And so to make a recommendation to get rid of them, you know, to erase that work, didn't seem justified. Now, I don't know that our recommendations preclude doing that 10, 20 years down the road. But certainly where we are now, with the Met Council not being as strong and as credible as we think it should be, it didn't seem to be a prudent recommendation. You know, I think the first step is addressing the council and the strength and accountability and stability of the council. And once that's in place, I think other things perhaps can open up. But certainly at this time, we didn't see the findings, just didn't take us there.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, too, just to remind everybody, we do recommend some consolidation. We think some of these are so small that there could be efficiencies gained if there were some consolidation. But as Ms. Randall said, I think it's a question of trading off that very, very local, face-to-face, literally, accountability that many local elected officials have for the tax that they impose and then the service they provide to people in their communities. And so you can literally go to the city council meeting or meet with the mayor, call him up, and talk about transit. As you move away from that level of very localized accountability and service, you get less face-to-face contacts. Not to say you can't keep some clear accountability, but it is a trade-off. There are undoubtedly efficiencies that could be gained. I would just reiterate, we were very impressed with the suburban providers and just the intensity of their commitments, their accountability to their local communities. And so given all that they've done, we just could not bring ourselves to a recommendation that you might expect from an auditor to weigh in on just on efficiency. We just couldn't come to that given what we saw.
Any other questions? Senator Scherer?
You mentioned one of the recommendations related to the Dan Patch corridor. I'm not sure where that is in here, but you know, that language that you're referring to that restricts that as a considered corridor was put in place for a reason. And if without knowing all of that history, I'm assuming it's because at some point somebody decided that should not be a part of the options for consideration for corridors. That when you're talking about options, don't think of this as one of them. You're suggesting that be undone, and I'd like to understand why you would do that against the reasons for which that the community decided that they did not want that to be a corridor.
Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. The discussion about the Dan Patch corridor is on page 88 in the report, where we're saying that Minnesota law prohibits consideration of all potential transit ways in the region. And our position here is multifold. First, that things change, and so we don't think it's prudent to take something off the table indefinitely. Again, we're not recommending that it be developed. We're not recommending that it not be developed. We're recommending that it be permitted to be part of the conversation. One of the things we heard as we were talking to people, you know, there's been a lot of discussion recently about the Southwest Corridor and the development of the light rail line down towards Eden Prairie. And a number of people we spoke with mentioned the fact that, you know, if Dan Patch were allowed to be part of the discussion, so not even developed, but just part of the discussion, the planning along Southwest Corridor might have been different. They might have located a station maybe a mile up or a mile down the line in anticipation of possibly 50 years from now that commuter rail line making sense. But because Dan Patch couldn't even be part of the discussion, they couldn't make those decisions. So I think part of the thing about transit is that it's interconnected, it's interwoven. All of these decisions, you know, rely on each other. So we think it makes sense for people to be able to have as much and the best information possible when making all of these decisions, because, again, they all kind of rely on each other.
And Mr. Chairman, again, I would just add to that, and I think we are aware of some of the historical roots here in the legislature for that prohibition. But those reasons can certainly be expressed yet again if this legislative mandated restriction were removed. So it would simply shift those into a discussion with the Metropolitan Council, with rail authorities, with everybody else in this panoply of organizations that are involved. And if they were compelling to the legislature, they might well be compelling to those who are planning regional transit ways. But to simply stop the discussion here in the legislature with a legislative prohibition, we thought did not advance the cause of transit in the region.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add one more thing. Dam Patch is unique in that it's the only corridor where a discussion is prohibited. And that was the other thing. You know, it really kind of raised a flag of why, you know, why prohibit anything, and especially just one?
Mr. Chair.
Maybe could you give us just a little bit of the history as to why it was prohibited? Some of us haven't been around here long enough to understand that.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's pretty simple. And I think it was stated by Senator Sharon. The people in the community didn't want it to be considered, and so they prevailed upon their legislators to enact a law that said what the law now says, that you cannot talk about it, you cannot discuss it, you cannot plan for it. It's a very broad prohibition in a setting where, again, I think you want the people planning transit. And again, this is not just the unelected officials at the Metropolitan Councils. This is also elected local officials who might well want to move forward, at least in the discussion, and yet this legislature passed a law that said you cannot do that. You cannot have that discussion. So, again, I would go back to if the arguments against Dan Patch are compelling, I assume they would still be compelling in any forum in which they're presented. And so I would say put them to the test in the planning process, put those arguments forth, and see what the result is. And it may well be the same, that people don't want it and it won't happen. But to prevent public officials, appointed and elected, from even discussing it seems a bit to be counterproductive to what we're trying to achieve with regional transit.
Maybe to be just a little more specific, was it more based off of a perceived route or a possibly proposed route at that point in time also? Or?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. I think it was very definitely that, seeing the possibility of exactly where a rail line would be and the people who would live next to that rail line didn't want it to be utilized for that purpose. And so, again, they came to the legislature and got the very expansive prohibition against that being discussed.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just responding to Senator Sharon with the caveat that I have no opinion or view of the Dan Patch line itself at all. But the if you read in the report, so not only did they pass a law, they came back and passed it again and again. So not only do we not want you to plan for it, we don't want you to think about it or even print its name. It is the line whose name shall not be spoken.
It sounds like the nuclear moratorium.
It's
like,
ponderator. This language was placed into statute. Remove all references. The Met Council is required to remove all references other than references for historical purpose to the Dan Patch commuter rail line from any future revisions to the Council's Transportation Development Guide and the Council's Regional Transit Master Plan. That was when they came back and kind of layered on top of it to pass another law to satisfy the pressure that was coming from the home communities. And you know, legislatures can do what they want, and we can pass whatever law we want. As a long-standing custom and tradition, though, in transportation policy in this committee as well as the House committee, we don't earmark our dollars for specific purposes when it comes to the roadway planning and spending. We do, of course, for transit because that's the way transit functions. But we've tried to get away from, you know, congressional style earmarking and really being really specific and telling the professionals how to plan and study and examine and you know to Auditor Noble's point, you know, let the science and the facts, you know, be put down on paper, and then let the community and political process engage. Dan Patch kind of preempted all of that, and quite unusual. And so that's kind of the history of this particular, you know, power of effective locals engaging their legislators, I guess. Hard to criticize that, but it is pretty unusual for us to do that.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a quick comment, Mr. Nobles. Thank you for all the good work that both of you have done. I think this is a very eye-opening report, very instructive. I'm looking at your PowerPoint presentation here and hoping you can go through just a couple of the numbers for me. I'm looking at your slide number 2 where it talks about the operating costs versus the ridership, and then I look down at your slide 5 and I see that the operating cost per rider is $3.24 there. Can you tell me how those numbers were achieved? When you speak of ridership, are you speaking per person, or is this going both to and from a location? Can you just kind of break down those numbers for me a little more specifically, please?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz. The rides are boardings, which means even if you transferred, you'd be counted twice. Mm-hmm. So it's however many boardings you make going to and how many boardings you make going back. So that's how rides are counted. Mm-hmm. And then the subsidy question, was that the other? I'm sorry, can you repeat your second question?
Mr. Chairman, the operating costs per passenger and how that breaks out with the $319 million over $81 million compared to the numbers that you have there in slide 5.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz. Let me get to that area of the report, if you don't mind. That will help, and I can direct us all. I might also call up Ms. Trupke to the table. She's the one who did a lot of our data analysis in that chapter, and she might be able to go quicker than me in explaining it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Julie Trupke. Senator Cruz, I believe some of the difference is the difference of what we've included in the two numbers. So the first slide, I don't know exactly if it's page 2 or slide 2, only includes the transit services that we had as our major part of our scope of the report, which was Metro Transit, the suburban transit providers. The data we use for the measures, in order to compare our region with other regions in the country, we had to use the National Transit Database data. And because of the way that data is reported and collected, included in the numbers for the Twin Cities region are also the U of M, North Star Commuter Development Authority, and the City of Ramsey numbers. So there's a little bit of different numbers included. So the total operating cost in the National Transit Database is a little bit different than $319 million, as well as the boardings are a little bit higher. And we have that data in our appendix if you'd like a copy of the appendix. We have those here as well.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could also ask one more quick question. Ms. Randall, as we look at I'm familiar with the makeup of the Metropolitan Council. I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about the makeup of the TAB and the CTIB. Specifically, I was under the impression that under the CTIB, it was not just county officials, but also municipal officials. Can you tell me if I'm correct in that assumption? And then could you also go into a little bit more detail about the makeup of the Transportation Advisory Board?
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, certainly. On page 10 in table 1.4, it lays out the Transportation Advisory Board members. So I'll just kind of summarize it quickly as you're turning to page 10. So there's a number of local elected officials. There's MODE representatives for non-motorized transportation, freight transportation, public transit, state officials, and then other representatives that are appointed from each council precinct. CTIB members, there are two voting members from each county that levies the sales tax. They are county commissioners. although, they're all county commissioners on CTIP. And the Met Council also has a seat. Thank you. And I just see now that the chair of CTIB is seated behind me, so hopefully he can help answer all those questions on CTIB when it's his turn up at the table.
Thank you, Ms. Randall.
Any further discussion? Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is the Metropolitan Council, the chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am first want to clarify that I'm not Chair Susan Haig and express her regrets that she could not be here this afternoon due to a previous commitment. My name is Wes Koistra. I am the Director of Finance and Administration at the Metropolitan Council, and I will, if its time is right, I will give our response to the legislative auditor's report.
Absolutely, the time is right, and if you don't mind, we will take questions as they come up.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. First, I want to express our appreciation to the Office of the Legislative Auditor for their effort, tremendous amount of effort committed to this report. Ms. Randall and her staff spent countless hours interviewing council staff, interviewing our regional partners, as well as reviewing many, many documents and attending many, many meetings. We got to know the Office of Legislative Auditor quite well during this time. We also appreciate the auditor's written comments and testimony, emphasizing that our regional transit system uniquely scores in the top tier of its peers in measures of both efficiency and access. I think in the report, it showed that we were in the top third in both categories of measure. That's unique. There were some other peer cities that may have scored a little higher in one tier, but may a little bit higher in another tier, but we were uniquely positioned in the top third of both tiers. Taxpayers, employers, businesses, and users all greatly benefit from a well-managed regional transit system, and we appreciate the effort made by the OLA to differentiate between what is proven to be a well-managed regional transit system from its criticisms of the council's structure of governance. We agree with many of the report's findings. The regional governance structure for transit is complex and fragmented. Effective coordination does require a committed effort on the part of the council and its regional partners to maintain a well-managed system. The report accurately points out that we have in many ways met this challenge. This is evidenced by our performance in those measures that we've already discussed and that the legislative auditor discussed. It's also evidenced by our work with CTIB, with the Transit Advisory Board, with MnDOT and other local partners to develop and maintain services and transitways in our region, and to secure significant grant funding from that ranges from the Urban Partnership Agreement that was significant to the development of bus rapid transit on 35W to more recent grants of HUD Sustainable Communities Grant, and the Living Cities Grant. Each of these grants were highly competitive grants that required the region to demonstrate effective partnership among the council, local governments, and other transit entities. For these reasons, we believe the report overstates issues of credibility and distrust among the regional partners. If it were not for those relationships, we would have not been considered for those funding grants. CTIB is a relatively new entity authorized by the legislature and has understandably taken some effort to structure the relationship between CTIB and the council. But we both believe that, that through the strength of this relationship, we have taken full advantage of opportunities to address current and future demands for regional services. The report is certainly correct in pointing out that tension exists between the council and suburban providers, but much of this tension is inherent to the council's regional oversight responsibilities and the limitations of regional resources that must be distributed among all interested providers. This limitation results from historical underperformance of the motor vehicle sales tax collections and recent reductions in state appropriations. There are always tension among partners when you are sharing limited resources. I think this body probably knows that very well. The report is also correct in stating that the recent work on procedures that will govern regional procurements and regional resource allocation improves the mutual transparency and accountability of these relationships. We believe that the report may have fell short of its charge to address the broad scope of regional governance, but we agree with the report's recommendation for improving the council's governance and agree that that recommendation is worth further consideration and further discussion. But it needs to take into account the full range of council responsibilities. We have pointed out in this committee before that we are not only responsible for the oversight of regional transit services, but we are also responsible for wastewater management and infrastructure and land use planning and parks. So any look at governance needs to consider the whole cloth of the council's responsibilities. And it should also be noted that the report correctly states that a change in council governance by itself will not address the issues of regional complexity. So we're prepared to work with those who are interested in pursuing this matter further. We think it's worth further consideration, okay. It's worth further discussion, and appreciate that this has been raised as part of the report's findings. That's the end of my comments, Mr. Chair. Well, I can take any questions. Well,
thank you, Mr. Koistra, and glad to hear that you're willing to be a partner in ongoing discussions about this. That'll be very helpful as we move forward with this, so thank you. Any questions on the committee? Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Koistra, is there, how are you?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I can only think that when my kids went awry when they were younger and we give them the responsibility to do things and to make things happen, that when we found that there were issues, we brought them back in. And I'm not so sure that I'm not sitting here today thinking that maybe this legislature should rein back in the duties and the powers of the Metropolitan Council. And I haven't been, what I've seen and what I've heard, I think we need to take a good, long, hard look at, because my initial impression right now is you're out of control. And out of control because you don't have what I consider those of us who have relinquished our power over the past, putting trust within the organization. And so I'm at this point where when I see this information, I'm very concerned. Very concerned about how we're gathering and using our taxpayer dollars. And some would say without real representation. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, how one moves forward or how much more information or what steps someone like myself would have to see to be confident that this trust is back. I mean, what steps do we have to take to get rid of some of the comments that we're seeing here? It's concerning to me at this point in time. Seeing this report.
Senator Perry, we do believe that we need to move forward with some discussion, and the council has agreed with that, and I'm, again, very appreciative that they want to be a partner in the discussion of how we can take this spider web and make it more clear and comprehensive and be able to move forward with transit planning in the metro region, but any ideas that legislators have concerning that, certainly I want to hear them, and I think others want to hear them, but we will be having that discussion as we move forward, I can assure you.
Well, Mr. Senator Chair, and I guess I, you know, and maybe it should be, maybe we should be looking at the goal of of taking back the authority or the power and using the Metropolitan Council, whatever it would end up being, as some form of an oversight committee. I'm not sure. I know there's a huge web with all the different parts from water and sewer, all of this melded together, and I think we need to take a look at a serious look at that.
Couldn't agree more, Senator Perry. Thank you for your comments.
Thanks. But
as far as regaining the trust, I think we have to take those first initial steps to find clarity and set all of our transit initiatives on a course that is understandable and transparent. And I think that has to be the goal in this process. And that's the basis on which we're going to move forward, certainly in this committee and with some other efforts that we'll be pursuing in the future. Senator Lilly?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Boystra, thank you for being here. As I'm looking through the legislative auditor's report, there are some challenging words that are stated here. And as long as we have a representative from the Met Council, maybe we can delve a little bit deeper into some of these recommendations. But the report, which is an independent report, it's not from your organization or it's not from a conflicting organization. These are independent folks who are stepping outside the process and taking an independent view of what they are seeing from the vested partners that are all working on transit and transportation in the metro area, are finding, using their words, fragmentation, complexity, distrust, time-consuming, and a need to set priorities. So those are issues that they find in our system the way it is currently set up. Out of that comes some recommendations, and one of those is looking at restructuring the Met Council. So I would be interested to know the Met Council's thoughts about the recommendations of restructuring the way that council members are selected, are appointed, are elected, and also having the staggered terms. Are those things that are being considered and discussed at the Met Council, or are there opportunities to look at some of the recommendations that are set forth in this independent report that still meet the complexities of the other services that the Met Council provides? Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Senator Lilly, I was on a little bit of a sidebar here with
Mr. Chair, ahead, Senator Mr. Lilly, I'll be happy to comment on some of that. I think, first let me say that as was mentioned by the legislative auditor, that we've just turned over the council. There are 16 new members of the 17. And there are discussions about this, and but I'm not prepared to represent a council position, but I can make some observations about that. First of all, I think it warrants more discussion because I believe in 1994 we did have staggered terms before that time, and then there was a group that was brought together by the legislature to decide to restructure the governance at that time and thought that more accountability was achieved by having all appointees have concurrent terms under the appointment of the governor. And that accountability then was to the governor as the elected official. I'm not suggesting that was the right decision. I'm not suggesting that we are more or less accountable than we were when we had staggered terms. I'm not suggesting that it is better or worse to have local government officials be part of that appointment as is recommended by the auditor. I think that at some moments, governance, the beauty of governance is in the eye of the beholder. And of course, when the council is governed under the leadership of one governor, there may be some people in opposition to the council's positions on things. And when it is under the leadership of another governor, there may be opposition. But it's worth considering. I think the issues of credibility that the legislative auditor brought forth was that the council members do not hold an election certificate. I've heard that. And I think that's a question that's worthy of consideration. It's not credibility in terms of what Senator Perry was suggesting, that we're out of control or we're making bad management decisions. To the contrary, the report was very careful to say that the management of the transit system in this region is being handled quite well. I would also add to that of all of the regional local governing bodies that have the authority to levy property tax, our property tax increases over recent years has been less than any other regional body. I think we take accountability seriously. I could show you the data on that. It's significantly less. Over the last 8 years, our tax increases as levied by the council have been a total of 8.7%, while I think the average for all local bodies have been over 50%. I'm only saying that to differentiate between performance of the council and the more philosophical question about the council's governance. I think the philosophical question is legitimate. I think when you make decisions that people, not all people like, they could easily point to the fact that all council members are appointed and they're all appointed by the same governor under concurrent terms. So if I seem like I'm hedging in a sense because we have a new council, we have a new governor. I'm also hedging from the sense because I see a lot of nuances to this discussion that need to be pursued with the time it takes to pursue those nuances. Because at one time, our current governance structure was changed to this structure because it was thought it was right. Now, if we're going to make the changes again, let's consider this in whole cloth and get it right the next time. I don't think we have a vested interest otherwise. There is redistricting that is occurring in a couple of years. Maybe that's the right timing to be thinking about these sorts of decisions. But I'm quite sincere in knowing that the council, that Chair Haig, and the governor has expressed interest in participating in the discussions.
Well, and I think you could probably appreciate that from an outside view looking in. I you said that governance is in the eye of the beholder. Well, looking from the inside, I'm sure that the Met Council is a glorious thing to the people that are serving on the council and others. But when you take a look at it from the outside, and certainly with a number of new sets of eyes around here, we see a spider web and the possibility of improvement. And I think that's what we're truly about and what we want to pursue.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say, I want to be clear that we see the possibility of improvement too. I'm not suggesting we got it right this time. I'm just suggesting that it's been changed in the past. It needs to be a thoughtful process.
I guess to expand on my comments, there does get to be a level of frustration amongst legislators when the complexities are so great that you can't seem to get the information for one thing that you want and get a straight answer and get to the core of what a function is. And that causes some issues for us as we try to make decisions that are proper in the use of the taxpayers' money. So that, again, is going to be our goal. Thank you for your comments. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To be sure, I think the Metropolitan Council needs this thinking, this conversation, some of the ideas in the legislative auditor's report. I'm pleased to see come forward because I have believed for a long time that its form doesn't really serve its function very well in many instances. And we've touched on some of those already here. It's levy authority without having elected officials sitting on that body is deeply troubling. And it's, and the comments in the report aren't a surprise. There's tension, among all the literally hundreds of local units of government that we have in the metropolitan area that we're trying to coordinate so that we function as a healthy whole in the metropolitan area. I don't think the report points to to Senator Perry's comment, an entity that's out of control. It does point to an entity that needs some serious examination and some consideration about how its form supports its function. The report does point to some things that the Metropolitan Council does really well. But we really need to have a conversation about how the Metropolitan Council improves the level of cooperation among local units of government, as well as to the region as a whole. And that's, that's a conversation I'm really interested in. I'm not interested in blowing up the Metropolitan Council, because we know for sure that those metropolitan areas in this country that do the best in terms of competing for brain power and research and economic competitiveness are those that have strong local democracies, city councils and county governments and park boards and the like, but have figured out a form and a fashion to coordinate their efforts so they're not competing against each other so much and wasting political capital and wasting resources and tripping all over themselves to compete for scarce dollars inside the metropolitan area, building too much infrastructure, et cetera, but are positioning themselves well to compete against regions like ours, compete on a national scale, and compete internationally. Those are the kinds of changes that I'm interested in seeing happen in this region and regionally. And it's a new day, Senator Perry. We've got a new governor, new set of council members. You know, maybe to the extent that the Metropolitan Council was out of control, it was because of times gone by in the recent past. And let's give this new crew an opportunity to kind of get, you know, put on their shoes and start walking down the path a little bit here and start interacting with us a little bit and see what the future might bring.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that point, Senator Dibble, I guess my understanding of the history was this council was put together to help construct. Okay? Have they outlived that charge? And should that charge now with this out here be turned back over to that the local units of government with still say some form of oversight and then now let the local units move forward? And I guess that's where I'm trying to understand this. What is next? If the structure is there, if the vision truly is there, is there a need for something other than that oversight group that makes sure that, you know, the water districts, sewer districts are taken care of and all this transportation issues now revert back to the local units of government? And those are discussions I think you would agree we need to – is that, in fact, what we have to go forward with?
Yeah. Mr.
Senator Dibble.
It's a fair question to ask and worth examining and, frankly, worth asking the local units of government what they think. I suspect the answer we'll find, but we should ask the question and do the analysis and answer the question because it's out there all the time. I mean, you know, should we just get rid of the Met Council, form some enhanced version of joint powers, and that's that. And we can proceed in the future. I think what we'll find is local units don't want that. They might say they do because they're cranky because their power is usurped sometimes from time to time, or they perceive it to be. But I think at the end of the day, if we build a structure where folks really are incented to cooperate, have the trust and the legitimacy and buy-in, you know, of a regional coordinating governance structure. And that's possible. Regions have done that, where they actually like their regional government and they work well with their regional government and with each other. It's entirely possible. It doesn't have to be like it is here. They'll find out that we build more infrastructure, we share services, we share costs for a lot less money, and we get more bang for our buck if we do it well and we do it right. That's kind of where we fall down here is all this tension. Tension is natural and it's good. It gives rise to good debate and good ideas and that sort of thing. Channeled correctly, tension can also be very destructive, and we kind of veer down that path a little bit in this region where tension is destructive and then people want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and we end up that much further behind other similarly situated regions in the country. That's what I fear. But I think we should have do the examination and see what the answer brings.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, to my good friend Senator Dibble, actually I have had conversations with local elected officials who are concerned. They're very concerned with the current structure of transit investment, the Met Council, the CTIB, the TAB, all these different levels. I have been told by a number of people within my district, leaders, county, city, that they would prefer the legislature to take back our responsibility to manage the monies that we should be managing, that the legislature, in their opinion, is a proper place to exert this regional outlook of how we should do things. and that there could be a situation where, you know, my recollection is that there are two cities in the country that have a Met Council type government. Here in, is it Seattle? I believe that.
Portland. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Portland.
Portland, thank you. Thank you very much. But that in most states, the legislature exerts more of a regional control or regional outlook, has that long-term perspective on investing in transportation, investing in transit, and is able to work with the local units of government to implement a policy of long-term structure, long-term support for a strategy that delivers good transportation systems within the region. So there are other models that are working. And again, my comment is not so much that we need to change the current system. I think it's a good conversation that we need to have. But there are local elected officials who are asking us to do just this. There are local officials who are asking us to change the way that we're doing things, to take back what they feel is our responsibility, and to exert our influence over these areas that they feel is appropriate.
Thank you. And we've just got about 12 minutes left, and we have three other entities that would like to weigh in to some degree on the and respond to this. But Senator Dibblewild, they're changing
quickly,
spots.
There are far more than just two regions that have Met MPOs and regional governance. It's not, and actually, Portland's is vastly different than ours. Portland's is directly elected. Every Salt Lake City. They all have regional governments. Salt Lake City, they all do. So, and we should analyze all of those and see what they look like. And Senator Lilly, we agree more than we disagree, actually. You know, I think the structure and form. Although I will say, eliminating the MPO and just putting everything back in the hands of the legislature, that means that a tiny subset of legislators are actually going to exert that authority over what happens in the metropolitan area, and we subject what happens in the metropolitan area to the whims and the vagaries of the entire state. I don't know if that's what you want as a metropolitan legislator. I suspect not. When you get into the weeds of politics around here, you find that self-interest can trump good governance quickly when it comes to these regional issues.
Somehow, as I look into the future, I see this debate continuing even directly between the two of you. So. Mr. McLaughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm chair of the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority and also chair of the County's Transit Improvement Board, and appearing on behalf of the County's Transit Improvement Board today. I've got four basic points I'd like to make in response to the report. One is that CTIB supports the basic recommendation that local elected officials should be on the Metropolitan Council. Two, and I would really emphasize this one, that the transit system in the metropolitan area is one of the very best performing systems in the United States of America. And the report found that. Number three, I think the report really fails to state in the very plain fact that the county's Transit Improvement Board did precisely what the state law directed it to do. And finally, that the report seriously mischaracterizes and overstates the level of disagreement and conflict between the Metropolitan Council and the County's Transit Improvement Board over regional transit priorities. And it kind of leaves the impression that somehow bad decisions are being made in the face of that, the tension and all that they state is there. So if I'll just elaborate a little bit, if I might, Mr. Chairman, on those points. The notion of having local elected officials on the Met Council, it kind of moves away from the original model, which is a group of disinterested, and that means non-elected, citizens making these decisions, and somehow that was going to elevate the level of decision making. It came about, some of the history, some people were asking for some history. There was chaos, for example, when the Met Council was finally created, about wastewater treatment. Water, a basic resource in Minnesota, and there were all these municipal systems. There was no city in the region that had the wherewithal to fix it. And so the Met Council, one of the reasons it was created was to start dealing with that and doing it on a regional basis. And we've got better water and a more efficient system of dealing with our wastewater than we had before. I think that bringing local elected officials in, I think it's a new model. It says that you bring people who stood for election and are accountable on that basis, and people who've actually made decisions in the public sector and have a stake in those decisions on an ongoing basis. That would bring a different flavor to the Met Council. We think that's would be a step forward. And as the Met Council indicated, we too would be very eager to participate in discussions on an ongoing basis of how the Met Council governance ought to evolve in the future. My second point is that this transit system performs really well. And I have two handouts, Mr. Chairman, that pertain to that. One is an article from former Chair Peter Bell, and secondly is a ranking from U.S. News and World Report that places the metropolitan system in the top as number five in the country as transit systems go. So I just would pass those out. You don't need to read them at this point, but I think they point out the fact that this transit system run by the Metropolitan Council in conjunction with these other organizations is actually performing. They looked at 11 peer regions. These are many of the same regions that we compete with every day economically. Denver, Phoenix, Portland, Seattle, for example. And then on measures of efficiency, effectiveness, on-time performance, and safety, we are in the top three or four on every measure. We have higher average fares, lower average subsidies, number two on subsidies per ride of all these 11 regions, and the only one that beats us is San Diego. And if you've ever been to San Diego, the one thing they've got is a trolley to Tijuana, well, to the border. That's a different beast, okay? And there are a lot of people that want to ride that, that want to take their cars into Mexico. And so they've got a special deal. But they're the only region among these 11 that beats us on level of subsidy per rider. So Chair Bell points this out, the performance. So I guess I would urge you to read pages 105 to 109 in this report and look at the performance. And if performance is what you want, and there's a lot of talk here that performance is what we ought to be looking for, we measure up. We measure up really well. And so if performance is what you want, this system is working and working well. I would, just in terms of benefits, there's a question of who benefits. There's a question of, is it just transit riders? No, it's not just transit riders. Met Council staff pointed out to me that on I-35W, the number of bus passengers on I-35W from the south coming into downtown Minneapolis, it would take a lane and a half of additional road capacity, a lane and a half of additional road capacity to carry all the people that the Met Transit system is carrying in on buses and the opt-outs are carrying in on buses. A lane and a half. And you start, if you remember how much the Crosstown project cost, you can imagine what it would cost to do an additional lane and a half on 35W coming into downtown Minneapolis. So, again, there are benefits for, and this is why FedEx, their representatives actually testified in favor of the Hiawatha Corridor LRT line. Getting people into transit is good for people who drive cars. It's good for people who drive truck. And those benefits are spread, very broadly. And so I think that we need to be looking at this broadly. And so that messy slide that you saw, it's messy. It's complicated. It's a complicated world out there. But the messy slide is producing results, bottom line, compared to other regions around the country and on a variety of measures. Number three, Mr. Chairman, the report fails to state that CTIB is doing precisely what the state told it to do. They told it to expand transit. They told us to make investments in conjunction with the Metropolitan Council to expand the transit system in this region, to help pay for operating costs, and to do it cheaply and efficiently. We have done all of those things. We have every vote that's been made for investments by CTIB, and there have been $317 million worth of investments made in less than 3 years by CTIB. They've all been unanimous votes. We have done it cheaply and efficiently. There was a statutory limit of 0.75% of annual revenues coming into CTIB that could be used for administration. We have lived within that statutory limit and are proud to say that we want to continue to do that. We don't own anything. We don't operate anything. We don't operate any trains, any buses. We don't have any staff. We contract out for the staffing. So we've tried, and I think succeeded, in being lean and mean in how we produce this investment in the region's transit and transportation system. I'm very proud of the fact that when it came to bonding, and the CTIB did its first bond issuance use of bond issuance in December of 2010. We saved, by having Hennepin County do the bond issuance, we saved $2.7 million. That was the estimate. But because Hennepin County is a veteran and an able participant in the financial markets. $2.7 million savings because Hennepin County issued the bonds on behalf of CTIB. In addition to that, because we issued the bonds in December, we were originally going to do it in the middle of January. By doing it in the middle of December instead of the middle of January, we actually saved about 40 basis points, about $2.3 million in present value. Both of these are present value numbers. So we think that by virtue of our stewardship in this bond issue, that we saved the taxpayers $5 million because of the work that we've done. So we think that, Mr. Chairman, that by making these investments and doing what the legislature said, expand the transit system, bring in federal funds. You know, over the years, we have the counties that have been advocating for these things. We brought in over $950 million in federal funds for transit investments, money that couldn't go to roads, money that, if we didn't get it, would go to Denver and Phoenix and Houston and all these other places. We've been able to bring in over $950 million, and when the Central Corridor full funding grant agreement is signed, as anticipated, in the middle of April, there'll be an additional $440, $450 million in federal commitment, money coming into this region that's going to pay contractors. I mean, I have a list of about 40 Minnesota businesses that have contracts to build the Central Corridor. And half the money for that is coming from the federal government, and if we didn't have the county's Transit Improvement Board and the sales tax and the investments, we never would have been able to receive the federal money. So there are businesses, and I guess in many of your districts, and many people living in your districts are working today and tomorrow and for the next 3 years constructing this, because we've been able to have a great reputation with the federal government and to be able to compete for very fiercely fought over federal funds that are going into this region to make the transportation system better. And I would point out, just on Hiawatha Avenue, just if you're worried, okay, highways would be a better way to go. The state of Minnesota put $100 million into the Hiawatha Corridor. That's all. It's over $700 million project. It was a $100 million investment. The state highway department, MnDOT, saved over $100 million because the road design on Hiawatha Avenue was changed. It was reduced in size because it was going to be complemented by LRT. So there's $100 million that's been invested in highway projects all over the state that otherwise would have had to be invested in Highway 55 through my district and other parts of Hennepin County. And so these systems, transit and highways, work together. We think we're making good decisions. And that brings me to my final point here, and I think it's maybe the most important. There's this overstatement of this disagreement on vision between the Met Council and the County's Transit Improvement Board. Grossly overstated, Mr. Chairman and members. We're not making decisions willy-nilly. The statute said, and we supported this provision in the statute, any investment that CTIB makes has to be consistent with the Met Council's long-term transportation plan. Every investment we've made has been consistent. And we're not, there's no disagreement. There's a big section in this report about there's differences on the maps about what should be developed in the region. It's kind of nonsense, to be honest with you. The fact is, what was the number one priority for transit investment in the region? Central Corridor. What was the first investment that CTIB made? Central Corridor. What was Met Council's next corridor? Southwest. We made investments there. We're working on the Gateway Corridor through Senator Lilly's district. We made special provisions so that Washington County could participate and use sales tax to plan that important corridor in the region. And guess what? It's an important corridor for the Met Council, too. There, on the big picture items here, performance, shared vision, there is real agreement between the Met Council and the County Transit Improvement Board. Yeah, there were some meetings where we pushed and shoved about who should pay for what and this and that. But that's, you know, we're trying to be good stewards over the resources that the taxpayers of our counties put at our disposal. You wouldn't want us to just say, oh, here, take the money and go, Met Council. You want us to be good stewards of the resources that the taxpayers in your district and other districts bring forward. So I think we've done a pretty good job. And I think that on the operating side,
which is there's this notion that somehow the operating money is kind of willy-nilly. There's been a plan for the operating budgets of these lines. There's been a plan. The fact of the matter is the state abrogated it on the plan, abrogated its responsibility on the plan over the years. Originally on Hiawatha, it was supposed to, the operations were supposed to be Met Council's responsibility, and the state was a contributor to that. In the budget crisis in the early 90s, Governor Plenty insisted that half the operating costs had to be paid for by the county through which the Hiawatha corridor went. We didn't like it, but we said, fine, we paid our 50% out of property taxes. Now, we've moved forward. We made it, when CTIB was created, there was a $30 million contribution from the sales tax, a one-time contribution to the Met Council, so that they could balance their budget. So we contributed to solving that problem for the state. Then, though, in all these years, there's been about a $2.3 million gap in the funding that the state was supposed to provide for Hiawatha Corridor that's never been funded. You can check that with Met Council. The locals have lived up to our side of the deal here. We've lived up to our side of the deal. It's the state that's been a little light on the operating side. So you ought not kind of conflate the issues of this some disagreement between Met Council and CTIB, which is overstated, but with the fact that there's no plan for operating money. There's been a plan on our side, and we've delivered on our commitments and over-delivered, as a matter of fact. We have plans, and I mentioned this to you, Senator, Mr. Chairman, when I first talked to you about this. We do spreadsheets on how CTIB's money is going to be spent over the next 20 years. In every one of those, we've got a 50% contribution to operating costs on any line that we plan to invest in. So we're planning ahead. And so finally, Mr. Chairman, on this role of the Met Council, I just think there does need to be a look at the federal law. There's a Metropolitan Planning Organization designation. The federal government, when it comes to transportation planning, says there should be a metropolitan entity that makes the plans, that allocates certain pots of federal money for transportation. And that's been central to the decision-making structure for a long, long time. So as you move forward and as we discuss this together, I think it's very important to look at what the federal law requires for us to receive federal funding, and one of those is to have a Metropolitan Planning Organization. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I'd just point out that I know people would like to reassert the state's role, but on these projects, on Central Corridor, on Southwest, and some of these other corridors, the state's contribution is 10%. 10%. The counties, our rail authorities, are contributing 10%, and the county's transit improvement board from the sales tax is contributing 30%. The feds provide the other half. So the state's getting a pretty good bargain here. And the combination of the financial contributions plus the federal law about metropolitan planning organizations, I think, argues for some more control at the metro level and not just having the decisions pulled back into the legislature to be made. But I'd be happy. We're happy to participate in those discussions in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, and again, we are glad to have you be a part of that discussion when we get to it here, and we will get to it.
Great, thank you.
We're going to move on with some brief comments from the Suburban Transit Association, who, and then right after them, Transit for Livable Communities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Will Branning. I'm chair of the Suburban Transit Authority, which is represented by 12 communities, six joint powers and or city organizations. The Joint Powers Association was formed in the mid-1880s, and it comprises joint powers boards and city organizations to represent transit in these communities. And in doing that, it works with Met Council to look at priorities and looks at how to provide the service to represent the constituents being very close to the elected officials that are served on these boards, the elected officials from Apple Valley, Burnsville, Eagan, and Rosemont are all members of this particular board, the Joint Powers Board, and they're represented by alternates that may be city staff, but they themselves attend these monthly meetings to look at the different activities that are going on, within joint powers. In 1981, the legislature reorganized the suburban communities to allow for what is referred to as opt-outs. I was a council member at that time, just newly elected, re-elected as council. I was also a former mayor of Apple Valley and worked very strong and very hard with Met Council and members of the legislature at that time to make it happen. I myself am the Dakota County Commissioner. I'm the Regional Rail Chair for Dakota County. I'm the Suburban Transit Authority Chair. I'm also the Metro Minnesota Valley Transit Chair, and I represent as co-chair the Cedar Avenue Transitway, which, by the way, Peter McLaughlin didn't mention the Cedar Avenue Transitway, which CTIP does participate in, although was not part of the New Starts or Small Starts. Cedar Avenue Transitway was done principally by initial $6 million from the federal under an earmark and $1 million under the state for planning. That we just issued a $34 million contract on Cedar Transitway to develop the shoulder right-of-way and the shoulders for the BRT from the Mall of America through into Lakeville. So it'll go approximately 8 miles, ultimately 16 miles. That is operated under the Met Council oversight. Myself and the Minnesota Valley Transit have been working, as well as other county commissioners working with Met Council, to make that happen. We started that project in 1998. This is now going on 12 years. We hope to have BRT running there 2012. I say hope to. We have all of the elements in place except for about $8 million for additional transit stops and a few additional changes. But other than that, it'll be approximately a $120 million project, started in 1998.
Mr. Branning, could we have you focus somewhat on your response to the legislative auditor's report?
I will do that right now.
I appreciate the overview
Mr.
of
Chair,
what you,
you
do, but we'd
Mr.
like to
Chair,
focus
I appreciate that direction. We are now going. I am now going to identify about 5, 6, 7 points in terms of the legislative audit. The OLA report confirmed that the region's transit system has performed well on measures of efficiency and effectiveness on a comparable basis. You've heard that before. We agree wholeheartedly on that. The report recognizes that our transit operations are well coordinated. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing. We believe that the efficiency and effectiveness of our regional bus transit system is in part a result of the competitive nature that we do. We have the new buses. We have coach buses. That was done under competitive nature, where the suburban transit providers did that, and now Metropolitan Transit is doing the same thing. We've done a lot of those things with the innovation. We could do it on a small scale or smaller scale. We had demonstration projects. We did that. And those are identified in the OLA report. While complex, the region has benefited from the expanded services, reduced congestion, and the regional innovations are a result of the suburban providers' presence and the initiatives they've undertaken. That's point number three. Point number four that I'd like to point out is that as a member organization, we have not taken a position on the Metropolitan Council reorganization. We have not. If the cities wish to do that, that's up to them. We do not wish to do that. Number five, we appreciate the report's recognition of the important role of the suburban transit providers and how they play within the regional transportation system. Specific recommendations by the suburban providers continue in operation. Ability to stay close to the needs of our riders and communities has increased the ridership. One more example, Cedar Avenue Bus Transit Station was opened in January of 2009. It was full, absolutely full. People continued to park on the road. So the planning and the need were coincidental. We believe the suburban providers should receive a proportional share of the supplemental MVEST revenue, which they do not today. We are concerned with the report's recommendation to expand the transit taxing district without raising the appropriate revenue to cover the additional transit taxing. We also know that, for example, expanding the transit district without providing additional capital and operating funds simply creates new inequities. Those are some of the comments we have on the report. I want to conclude, Mr. Chair, with the a positive statement in the sense that we have the OLA auditors worked extremely and worked very hard with the local elected officials. Many phone calls took place. Many interviews took place with the local elected officials. They took place with the communities that I just mentioned, and they came out and visited us. Jim Nobles and his team did an outstanding job. Judy Randall, I don't know if she could have spent any more valuable time of her time with us than she already did. She was a wonderful leader. Emmy Bennett, getting the detailed data was important, as well as Julie Trupicki. So with those people, we're confident that the report is a fair report. It was non-biased report, and we appreciate everything they did. And although I have 4 pages of information, I'd open it up for any comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Branning, and I appreciate your comments and your insights, certainly on the report itself. And if you would be willing to make your comments available, we'll see that all of the committee members get those. And also, I just call to the attention of the committee members that there are responses in the back of the legislative auditor's report here. So, again, we appreciate it very much.
Mr. Chair, who should I give this report to for a comment?
Senator Dibble.
I just wanted to extend my greetings to my former mayor, Commissioner Branning.
I see.
Yesterday we had someone in here representing Apple Valley, or District 196, my school district. Now we have former municipal officials here. It's old home week here in the Senate for me.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I appreciate that, and thank you much. There's also another member that have worked very hard and very long with the senator, that he's now vice chair of this committee, and I know him very well, and thank you.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Commissioner Brandon for those comments, and it was nice working with you. Hope to work with you in the future, too.
Well, I understand you didn't give up your position.
Yeah, I maybe they need a formal letter from me, but I've been replaced.
Thank you, Mr. Branning. We'll hear from the Transit for Livable Communities.
Again, I thank you.
Thank you.
You identify yourself for the committee. Sure. Appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Dave Van Haddam. I'm with Transit for Livable Communities, and appreciate the opportunity. I'll be brief, but want to hit on a couple of points that maybe haven't been touched on. Our organization, with a couple of others, produced a somewhat similar report, a little broader scope, looking at metropolitan governance, bringing in both transportation and land use. So I encourage you to take a look at the executive summary, at least. These have been in your mailboxes, but we're happy we have some here today. Like others, we applaud the legislative auditor's report. It's a great resource. It's a great examination of performance in our region. But I think before getting to the governance issues, we should really take note of why we invest in public transit. We do so to save families and businesses money and to get people to work into other key destinations. The American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, which is sort of the MnDOTs of the country, they report that every dollar invested in public transit results in over $6 in economic benefits. Those benefits include reduced congestion delays, infrastructure savings, reduced costs to consumers to operate cars, reduced emissions, and increased safety. As others have noted, the unmistakable conclusion of the auditor's report is that our metro system is run very well, our metro transit system. We agree with the report's conclusion that there remains a very high level of pent-up demand for transit in the Twin Cities. And we should note that while the system is run very effectively, it remains quite small compared to our peer regions. We also agree with the recommendation to streamline governance at the Met Council by including elected officials. We do have a couple of critiques of the report. First, the idea that there are not clear priorities for transit is vastly overstated. The priority for transit, as the legislature has articulated for years, is high ridership per dollar invested. And on that metric, we're third among the 12 peer regions. No doubt there's tensions between providing transit for those without cars, getting them where they need to go, and attracting new riders and getting cars out of congestion. But that's really no different than the tension that MnDOT faces or virtually any public investment. Second, we believe it's problematic that the impact of local land use decisions on transit effectiveness was not included in the auditor's report. The extent of compact, mixed-use centers, and walkable neighborhoods provides a far greater impact on transit performance than any variation in governance. If you look at the five regions in their study that outperformed us in terms of ridership, they're all denser than us. They're not necessarily bigger, but they're denser, and that allows their transit system to work more effectively. Planning for density is planning to succeed, the name of our report. It's about preparing for the new economy and for changing market preferences. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that Gen Yers, which are the largest demographic of home buyers, they're looking for homes where they don't have to depend on a car, at least not both spouses, and where they have walkable neighborhoods with transit service. So to conclude, we believe public transit is a smart investment for Minnesota and that the Twin Cities region provides it in a very effective manner. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and appreciate it. There being no other, Senator Perry.
Just a question and not for Mr. Van Hatten. Senator DeCryf and I were with the Governor of Mankato on flood preparation. Do you get any kind of update from MnDOT on any areas of the state that we're concerned about in the upcoming floods? I mean, there was some good discussion for the cities, you know, in southern Minnesota, and I'm just wondering, is that something that we're apprised of?
It happens to be a great coincidence that on Thursday we'll have MnDOT in here to talk about their efforts and their thinking on flood issues.
A little ESP we'll here, huh?
Yeah. I think about an hour of discussion
okay,
on that
good.
Very topic.
Good.
So thank you for bringing it up and
thanks.
Giving me the opportunity to plug our next committee hearing. So, there being no other business before the committee, we stand adjourned.